May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is Tad McCraney, and I'm counsel for the plaintiff appellant, the Chapter 7 trustee, Derek Henderson. This is a preference action which was filed under 11 U.S.C. Section 547B of the Bankruptcy Code, whereby the trustee is seeking to avoid two wire transfers which totaled $3.5 million that the defendant appellee received from the Chapter 7 debtor, Stinson Petroleum, Inc., on July 10, 2009, after the discovery and collapse of the debtor's check-kiting scheme. The check-kiting scheme at issue involved two banks, Community Bank in Ellisville, Mississippi, and another bank, Bank of Evergreen, in Evergreen, Alabama. The kite was perpetrated because the debtor was circulating worthless deposits, checks that he was depositing in his Community Bank account, and checks that he was depositing simultaneously that were worthless in the Bank of Evergreen account as they circled each other at the Federal Reserve level as checks are presented for ordinary course collection. He was accruing a substantial debt. Bank of Evergreen ultimately discovered what the debtor was doing, froze the account, the kite collapsed. Ultimately, Community Bank is on the wrong end of the kite, with the debtor owing about $6 million in overdrafts. What we're here about is what the Community Bank's reaction once it discovered that it was on the wrong end of that kite. What it did was, after it learned that it was on the wrong end of the kite, it raced down to Bank of Evergreen and cut a deal to get all of the debtor's available funds that were in the Bank of Evergreen account at that point, which was $3.5 million. That wasn't enough to cover the overdrafts, so Community Bank also cut a deal with the debtor where it got a promissory note and a forbearance agreement for the difference. So we had two transactions going on, a $3.5 million wire transfer from Bank of Evergreen. Then for the difference, we had a forbearance agreement and promissory note with the debtor. The trustee sued to invalidate both transactions as preferences under 547. The parties ultimately settled the forbearance agreement issue and proceeded to trial on the $3.5 million wire transfer. The bankruptcy court...
The bankruptcy court wrote a very, very thorough opinion, and as did the district court. And in both opinions, and of course we review the bankruptcy court as if it was as just the standard district court uses, but in both opinions there was emphasis on the fact that all of the theories being raised for why Community Bank improperly improved its position, making this a preferential transfer and therefore avoidable, that there was insufficient evidence. I think the evidence presented was called scant, et cetera, et cetera. So what's your response to that, that the district court said the bankruptcy court's finding was not clearly erroneous, and we'll look at obviously, we'll take a look at that. We'll look at what the district court said, but it seems like there are about 33 million opinions being offered or bases being offered by you for why the bank improved its position, but each court said you failed to prove that.
Yes, Your Honor, and in response to that, the bankruptcy court, where it went wrong is focusing on whether or not Community Bank took control of the kite. That was what its opinion turned on. The issue was not whether Community Bank took control of the kite and directed kiting activity as what was going on in the Montgomery decision, which was fully briefed below. But our position was that's not the issue. The issue is whether it improved its position. You don't have to prove that they took active control of the kite. So we appealed that decision to the district court. The district court framed the issue correctly, which is whether it improved its position, and didn't really even look at whether it took control of the kite, because that wasn't really relevant. But the district court said there was insufficient proof on that issue, and we take issue with that for two reasons. One is the record evidence, which I'll get to, but as a threshold issue is the district court's opinion doesn't properly analyze the security interest at issue. It assumes that Community Bank's security interest was unchanged throughout. But you have to first of all look at what was Community Bank's security interest to begin with. It had security interests under Article 4 of the UCC in each of the kited checks at issue. It did not have a blanket security interest in the funds in the account. It could not reach into the Bank of Evergreen account at any point in time and seize those funds. That was undisputed. It was undisputed based on Darren Dodd's testimony that when
you need to tell us who when you mention a name to us, tell us the entity with which they're associated.
Darren Dodd was the president, then president of Community Bank, who was involved. He was at the meeting on July 9th.
Right.
Shortly after the kite was discovered, got with the debtor, went to Bank of Evergreen to figure out how much money would be in that account and how to get it. They didn't have a right to reach into that account, and Darren Dodd admitted, I couldn't go down there on July.
But do you agree, though, that they were a secured creditor?
As to each individual check. They were.
But a check is just a piece of paper, and when you say secured creditor, they got a secured interest in it. In accessing funds to cover those checks.
They do. They
you
have
agree with that?
Yes, sir.
All right.
They have a right, they have an unrealized security interest in that check, which is not realized until they receive a payment on it. All they have is a right to present. No dispute that they could have done that, but that's not what they did, and that's where the district court's decision goes wrong. What they did is, see, they want to call this an Article 4 transaction. It's not. The reason they got paid when they got paid is because they struck a side agreement, a settlement agreement with Bank of Evergreen.
But isn't the real issue, though, whether or not they improved their position to one which was different from and better than what they would have been in under a bankruptcy?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And the reason they improved their position was...
Well, it sounds to me like you're quarreling with how they got the money. Not that they were entitled to it, just how they went about accessing it.
That's a big part of it, because because they improved their position in getting a... They fundamentally altered their security interest through this settlement agreement. They went from having simply a right to present checks to a paramount right to seize the fund. By having a right to present checks gives them no greater priority than anybody else who is holding a check. It doesn't give them a first-in-line status to walk in there and present a check. If they get paid on that check in the ordinary course through Article 4, Article 4 says they have realized their security interest.
They're not entitled to cut through the red tape.
Sir?
They're not entitled to cut through the red tape.
Right. They can't say.
But what in substance did they gain?
In substance, they gained $3.5 million that they wouldn't have otherwise had a mechanism to garnish in a bankruptcy proceeding. Because that's the issue, is not whether they could have at some point along the continuum presented these checks. Because you got to remember where these checks were.
But they would have,
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
They would have been entitled to it in a bankruptcy proceeding.
Not necessarily $3.5 million, and even their own witnesses couldn't say when, if, how, or to what extent they would have been paid. But what they're trying to do, and they got the district court to buy into this argument, is that the proof left open that theoretical possibility that at some point along the continuum they could have presented these checks and maybe somehow gotten $3.5 million. Of course, their witnesses couldn't say how or when. Even their expert witness couldn't say how.
But there's a difference.
Let's drop back to the dates. As I understand it, Bank of Evergreen closed at noon on Wednesday, July the 1st. I'm not sure that closing is necessarily relevant here. But then Bank of Evergreen closed on Friday, July the 3rd, which was not a national banking holiday. The Federal Reserve was still open.
Correct.
And I'm not sure when these checks were coming in, these 18 checks that we're talking about, but when Bank of Evergreen put a hold on those funds on 6 July and then returned those 18 checks, Community Bank filed, you know, your late, it's claimed that they were late and not in refusing those checks and had those late return claims. And so that was what was up in the air when they met on 9 July. And I don't know how the Federal Reserve would have resolved that, but had the Federal Reserve agreed with a community bank or through litigation that those returns were late, Bank of Evergreen was on the hook, as was Stinson, for the full amount of those 18 checks. And so Stinson approved this deal, Bank of Evergreen approved this deal, and Community Bank approved this deal, this settlement. And Community Bank received $3.5 million against an overdraft of around $8 million. So, you know, you're making it sound like Bank of Community Bank, and I know you don't mean this, but, you know, snuck into Bank of Evergreen and took money out of the account, when in fact all three parties sat down and reached this agreement. And then at the trial, Judge Olak, two-day trial, heard this evidence and said they are in no better position than they would have been in the hypothetical Chapter 7, based on testimony by Mr. Karuba, among others, that this is standard practice when you have a kite like this, et cetera, to reach some settlement. So, again, it seems that as many interesting arguments as you've presented, and you certainly are dogged in your representation of your client, again, it appears that it simply was the bankruptcy court and was the district court clearly erroneous in their findings that this is what they would have received in the hypothetical Chapter 7.
Well, let me highlight this with two points. First is Community Bank did what any prudent bank would have done in the situation. It's still a preference. Number two is that the district court said in its opinion that there was no evidence that Bank of Evergreen wouldn't have honored the checks at some point.
Had they been represented after the hold was lifted, they could have come back in, represented those checks after the hold was lifted. Well, and there was there were several million dollars in that account.
Right, it would have been available to any creditor,
right,
if they hadn't locked it down with the settlement agreement, which was, as the evidence is unrefuted, was an issue between the banks. The late return issue was an issue. What they did was deploy the debtor's assets to settle a claim between the banks. That's still a preference.
With the debtor's consent. I know that doesn't change
anything.
Of course it's. But you had all three agreeing that this would.
Well, of course the debtor.
And that you had testimony by witnesses that this is a standard banking practice.
But the important factual point about whether the bank would have gotten 3.5 anyway is that Bank of Evergreen testified that without that settlement agreement lifting that liability from Bank of Evergreen, they were not sending the money to Community Bank. So the big issue was, how are you going to get paid if you don't have the settlement agreement? And so what they want to say and what the district court bought into was, even though we didn't follow Article 4, what we did was we got a three-legged agreement with the debtor, Bank of Evergreen, and us, and we got paid outside the ordinary course of check presenting through the Federal Reserve. And even though seven of the 18 are tied up at the Federal Reserve level, even though we went through all these machinations and had information about where the money was, when it was going to be available, when the holds were coming off, how much we would get, and in fact let the debtor pay some of the money to cover payroll, they say none of that matters because we could have gone through Article 4.
Well, let me ask you this, and you know, it's not real helpful when you say the bankruptcy court bought into that. I mean, the district court bought into that. This is a fine district judge. I know you're not
absolutely.
Showing
I'm
any
not implying.
Disrespect
I'm saying
to him,
they accepted the argument.
He accepted the argument. Let's assume this, that within 90 days, because he took bankruptcy within a month of this.
Yes.
Chapter 11 converted to 7. Let's assume that 2 weeks before he took bankruptcy, Community Bank had represented those checks and they'd been paid. That would not have been a preferential transfer, would it?
Nope, and that's not what happened. They weren't going to let that happen because if...
I understand that, Mr. McCraney, but I just wanted to have that on the record, that would have been perfectly fine.
If they had followed Article 4, yes, but that's not what they did because they knew that if they didn't lock up that account, the debtor had just tried to access the funds 2 days earlier. There were other checks, that's in the record as well, that were being presented and rejected on that account during this same time period. The only way to get their hands on all of the 3.5 in that account was to do what they did and enter a settlement agreement that locked it up and gave them a superior lien to it, excluding all others, and contractually obligating Bank of Evergreen to hold it for them and not let the debtor have access to it or anybody else. And that's how the preference arises, Your Honor. I think my time is up, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Crawford?
Thank you, Your Honors. Jack Crawford with the Butler Snow Firm on behalf of Community Bank. Your Honors, the bankruptcy court didn't commit any error, much less any clear error. There are three reasons why this court must affirm. First of all, no proof. The trustee simply failed to meet its burden of proof. Number two, Community Bank had a fully secured security interest in those returned 18 items. And payment to a fully secured creditor is not a preference under Fifth Circuit law. And lastly, the trustee's attempt to overturn the decisions in Braniff versus Exxon and then El Paso Refineries and in Flash Foundation is not appropriate and should not be followed by this court. Three reasons. The first one, no proof. Your Honor, it was their burden of proof to show that Community Bank received more by the two wire transfers than it would have in a hypothetical Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And as stated by the Fifth Circuit, it was the obligation of the trustee to show that there was no possibility of 100% recovery. And I'd like to just point out something.
We're going to have a little problem if you want to be over there and away from the microphone, too. Can you possibly pull it closer to the mic so we can get your speaking words recorded?
Yes, Your Honor. In the trustee's brief to the district court, here's a paragraph that they put in their brief. Now, remember, it's the trustee's burden of proof to prove that Community Bank received more than it would have in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And they start off, in order for Community Bank, this is in their brief, in order for Community Bank to realize this same recovery post-petition in a Chapter 7, one must assume two facts which are highly unlikely. Well, right there, Judge, they concede that they didn't meet their burden of proof. The debtor implicitly concedes in his brief that he didn't meet his burden of proof, because what he tries to do is to switch the burden. And he says, and on appeal, one must assume two facts which are highly unlikely. Well, the assumption of facts that are highly unlikely is not meeting his burden of proof to prove by preponderance of the evidence that we failed, that we got more than we would have in a hypothetical Chapter 7. And then he goes on. He says, first, it is highly unlikely that the debtor would have preserved all of its available funds up and through the filing date. He didn't put on the debtor. The debtor didn't testify. The debtor never said, I wouldn't have maintained my funds. He didn't put on any proof of that point. That's just a rank assumption. And then he goes on. In fact, based on the circumstances, it's highly likely that the debtor would have used some or all of these funds for its own benefit or to pay some other of its squeaky wheel creditors. Well, in addition to the fact that debtor didn't testify, he didn't put on a single squeaky wheel creditor. There wasn't a single person that testified that said, hey, I've got a check that bounced. I wanted to represent it, and I couldn't because Community Bank had taken all the money. No proof, not a single squeaky wheel creditor. Once again, he's trying to raise an assumption on appeal. Second, it is highly unlikely that Community Bank could have presented and demanded payment of the checks to this same extent in a Chapter 7. Well, where's his expert? Does he have an expert, financial expert, that says that? No. Does he have a banking expert that says it's highly unlikely? No. He didn't put on any single proof. And by his statement in his brief, Judge, he confirms that he didn't meet his burden of proof, and this court should affirm. Now, before the Court of Appeals, he changes the words highly unlikely to it's simply not plausible. But we all get the same gist, is that he's trying to get this court to make assumptions of something being highly unlikely on appeal, which is not the honoring of his burden of proof, and there's no clear error by the bankruptcy judge and the district court properly affirmed.
What did the bankruptcy judge and the district judge base its opinion on, that there was no preference? What did they give any evidentiary facts or?
They did. Which gets into my next point, Judge, which is under the Fifth Circuit, payment to a fully secured creditor is not a preference. And so the bankruptcy court looks at it and says, okay, I got a payment to a fully secured creditor. Mr. Trustee, what's your argument around that? And that's what, as Judge Barksdale said, is we've got a lot of creative arguments where the trustee comes up with about 9 or 10 different arguments to try to get around that bedrock law that payment to a fully secured creditor is not a preference. And none of those are availing. And so the trial, all the evidence that's being put on, since it was stipulated that we had security interests, were just really basically refuting these alter arguments that the trustee was trying
to. Well, I suppose his argument is payment to a fully secured creditor is not a preference as long as the payment is through the instrument securing to which a security interest attached, i.e. the check, but payment to the creditor through a settlement agreement of this type is not the normal payment of a fully secured of a security interest.
Well, Judge, the undisputed evidence at the trial was by Paul Karuba, industry expert, that it is industry standard in the face of a check-kiting situation like this for banks to enter into settlement agreements and to resolve the issue of late return claims or those types of matters that arise. And he also testified that it's industry standard to settle for return checks with a wire transfer. That's industry standard. When you've got bounced checks, in lieu of rerunning them, it's industry standard to settle for those checks via wire transfers. And so there's the trustee didn't put on any proof from some industry expert that this settlement agreement was anything other than industry standard. And therefore, he failed to meet his burden. So first point, no proof. Second point, Your Honors, since Community Bank was fully secured, payment to a fully secured creditor is not a preference. And that's what the Fifth Circuit law says. Article 4 of the UCC, 75-4210, granted Community Bank a duly perfected first priority security interest in the returned items, the proceeds of those items, and all the accompanying documents. And that was stipulated and agreed to in this case. We're a fully secured creditor. The Fifth Circuit in Braniff Airways. All right, well, let me back up. You got two wire transfers that are transferred with the debtor's authorization and instruction, two wire transfers sent from the Bank of Evergreen to Community Bank. The undisputed testimony, the undisputed evidence in the record is that those two wire transfers satisfied the first seven items, the late returned items. And therefore, it was a final, full and final settlement of those first seven items, which under 75-4210C was a realization and satisfaction of those items.
But you know, it's interesting because the first wire transfer had the numbers for the first three checks that had been presented to Bank of Evergreen, you know, in payment of those three checks. The next wire transfer just said in payment of checks, I forget what it said, but it did not list the other four checks to which you're referring, which I had understood to mean, well, This is just the balance that we're going to be able to pay out of this man's account, and we're not designating any particular check. How would that affect this being an accepted method of paying for these first seven checks? What's the proof that these were the second payment was for four other specific checks?
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. That's a good question. But first of all, it wouldn't matter whether it was just payment for return checks in general or if it's payment for specific checks. But the proof that Community Bank put on by Darren Dodd, who was the then president of the Community Bank branch that was down there, he testified that it was his understanding that in their discussions that would be what the purpose of the wire transfer would be to satisfy and to resolve the disputed return check claims. And therefore, his testimony is that his understanding was that the $3.5 million satisfied those seven disputed checks. And that was his testimony. Paul Karuba testified, based on his expertise in reviewing and analyzing it, along with the depositions and the testimonies of the parties, that it was his professional expert opinion in the banking industry that those two wire transfers satisfied those first seven items. The trustee put on no contrary evidence. Brand of Fairways versus Exxon. Any payments to a fully secured creditor are not preferential because the creditor does not receive more than he would in a Chapter 7 liquidation. El Paso Refinery. A fully secured creditor who receives a pre-petition payment does not receive a greater percentage than he would have in a bankruptcy proceeding because as a fully secured creditor, he would have recovered 100% payment in a bankruptcy proceeding. N.A. Flash Foundation, Fifth Circuit. It was trustee's burden to demonstrate that 100% recovery was not possible. Thus, his failure to present any evidence on this issue is fatal to his claim. Community Bank was a fully secured creditor. Payment to a fully secured creditor under Braniff, El Paso, Flash Foundation is not a preference. Therefore, this court should affirm. Last point, Your Honor, the trustees' attempt to overturn Braniff and El Paso and Flash Foundation is just simply unavailing. The test that the Fifth Circuit insists on is a status test, and which is the trustee agrees with in his brief. The court is to first look, was the creditor fully secured, partially secured, or unsecured? That's the test, okay? The trustee advocates, well, let's create a different test, a new test. And he essentially seeks to overrule the court's decisions that I've just cited to you. And he says, this court should adopt a unrealized versus realized test. And if a creditor was unrealized, the secure creditor was unrealized during the 90-day window and then became realized, well, then that's a preference. And then he goes through and he cites and uses different definitions for the term realization. And he says, well, that really means that the Article IV security interest was inchoate. It was incomplete, ineffective. It had not come into full existence. And therefore, the payment of it then caused it to then be complete. Well, then we get it and we look at it. And of course, the proper definition of realization in this context is the conversion of any type of property into money. I mean, that's the use of the term in the UCC, converting any type of property into money. Well, when we use the proper definition of the term realization, then it's just shocking what he's advocating. He's saying that anytime somebody receives money in satisfaction of their security interest during the 90-day window, that's a preference. And so, literally, every single check that clears, what he's saying, well, okay, you got paid, and therefore that's a satisfaction of your security interest. Well, we got to go into hypothetical Chapter 7, and you got to reverse that transaction, and therefore you've got an unrealized security interest in your check. And that would bring the banking industry to its halt if that were to occur. Well, then what he says in his brief says, well, no. I don't intend for that to apply when it's ordinary, normal check processing, okay? So I want to carve that out of my hypothetical new theory that I don't have any case law to support, using the wrong definitional terms. But this case proves that he's wrong, or he proves that this will be an explosion of cases, because the undisputed evidence in the record is that the satisfaction of the returned items via a wire transfer is industry standard. Yet my poor client standing here in front of the Fifth Circuit having to argue over it, and it proves our point that this will cause a proliferation of litigation. The undisputed evidence is that what we did was industry standard, yet we're still having to argue over it. Therefore, the court should reject that request for an alternative test, which is in contrary to the panel decisions of the cases that I've already cited to you. Lastly, Judge, the trustee then comes up with another argument, and you do have to give him credit for creativity and trying, but he takes the Montgomery decision, which is in the Sixth Circuit. And the Montgomery decision in the Sixth Circuit dealt with a situation where there was an ongoing check kiting going on, and the bank discovered it. And at first, the bank says, shame on you. What I'll do is we'll set it up as a loan each night, and I'll charge you interest off of this. And they know that they're tapping this provisional credit and using it as float for an unauthorized loan. And so they said, well, I'm not going to let you get away with it for free. I'm going to start charging you interest. Well, then the bank finally got tired of it and said it was too much and too high. And so they met with the debtor and came up with a plan to get the bank out. And so then the bank would only accept deposits but would not let any checks go through. And so over the course of 60 or 70 days, the bank extricated itself from the kite, was made 100% whole, and they essentially assisted the debtor in shifting the kite and forcing it out on other parties. Okay? Nowhere in that case. All right, so what happens is the bankruptcy court says preference. District court, it gets all the way up to the Sixth Circuit, and they affirms, yeah, preference. Okay? But nowhere in that case do they even discuss an Article IV security interest. It's not an Article IV security interest case. It wasn't raised. And so the trustee then says, well, I tell you what, Judge, what we need to do is create a different test here for the Fifth Circuit, and it's creating an exception to the enforcement of an Article IV security interest. And we're going to use the Montgomery decision as the basis for that, even though the Montgomery decision didn't mention anything about security interest. And he says, and here's his test. If the creditor, Community Bank, used extraordinary collection methods or any action outside the ordinary course to get a realization of its security interest, regardless of whether it has a security interest, it's a preference. So if the creditor used extraordinary collection methods or an action outside the ordinary course, then they get to trump our security interest. That's his proposed test. It's not a Fifth Circuit law. It's really contrary to the panel decisions already before the court. Bottom line is even if the court were to adopt that, which it shouldn't because it's using a case that doesn't have anything to do with security interest to try to have a carve out his security interest, he didn't offer any expert testimony. He didn't establish what the ordinary course in the industry was. He didn't set up what ordinary collection methods are. So even if you were to adopt that rule, he has no proof. Zero. Didn't put on any evidence of that. In fact, the only evidence in the record is by Paul Karuba that says it was standard in the industry for two banks like Community Bank and Bank of Evergreen to enter into a settlement agreement. And it's industry standard to settle for return checks via a wire transfer as opposed to having to just rerun them. It's just easier. You wire me the money, I'll send you the items.
But your expert, in testifying that this is industry standard, did he ever say, and by this I mean, in effect, by this I mean it's in the ordinary course of business? Because when we think of handling a check in the ordinary course of business, we think about presentment and payment or return.
It is industry standard. It is not, his testimony was not that this is the same as running them through the Federal Reserve. I mean, it's a different procedure that gets you to the same point. And both are accepted in the industry.
But did he ever say this is consistent with the ordinary course of business?
Using the wire transfer?
Yes, sir.
I don't believe he did. Your Honor, we'd ask that you affirm the bankruptcy court and the district court. Thank you.
Mr. McCraney, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, the problem with Community Bank's position and the district court opinion is that we have an Article IV process that wasn't followed here. And then after the fact, they're saying, well, it doesn't matter. We could have followed Article IV, and so this doesn't really make a difference. But the precedent that's being set is that a bank that gets caught up in a kite can basically do whatever it wants to, whatever it can do. And I'm not saying they shouldn't. They reasonably and prudently should, but they're still subject to preference attack and a preference challenge. And if a bank that gets caught up in a kite could basically force a debtor, put a debtor in a headlock, or a potential debtor, because you get caught in a kite, odds are pretty good you're sliding toward bankruptcy, put the debtor in a headlock, do whatever you can to get paid through whatever means, whether it be a settlement agreement on late returns or forcing a debtor to sell property and then converting it and saying, well, that's proceeds and we've applied it to the overdrafts created by the check kite.
Well, was he right when he cited to El Paso and the fact that it seems to say a pre-petition payment to a secured creditor is not a preferential transfer? Is that what El Paso says or not?
In general, that is correct. But what that requires you to do is analyze what the security interest is and what it attaches to, which gets back to the point of what was their security interest.
Let's do it this way. We agree we had a pre-petition payment.
Absolutely. Stipulate.
We agree they were a secured creditor.
As to each check.
All right. And we agree that there was a transfer.
The $3.5 million wire transfer.
El Paso says that's not a preferential transfer.
Well, the transfer that they received is preferential because they didn't, again, you got to look at what would have happened in a hypothetical Chapter 7. In a hypothetical Chapter 7, in the absence of the settlement agreement, all they had was a right to present each individual check. They had no right to grab $3.5 million in one fell swoop in a transfer. There was no single check for $3.5 million. They couldn't just show up with a check for $3.5 million and say, here, at the bank teller window, honor our check. That wasn't possible. And they could, and they can't contend otherwise.
But that, they had that late returns claim pending,
which was an issue, as they testified, between the banks. It didn't involve the debtor or the debtor's funds. In fact, Judge, that.
But it does affect the fact that the checks were not honored.
Right, and they deployed all of the debtor's assets to settle an issue between the banks at the Federal Reserve, and this is in the record. When they filed those late returns, the Federal Reserve automatically debited Bank of Evergreen's account. You know, so that money already had shifted at the Federal Reserve. So they deployed the debtor's full assets to resolve that issue. If they had let, and their own expert admitted this, if they had let that late return issue play out, they would have lost. Their expert admitted the returns were all timely. So what happens in a chapter?
Because of that unusual bank closing on the 3rd of July, I suppose.
Sure, but even their expert admitted that was within their prerogative to close. That was not, and the way the check collection and presentment regs work if that bank is not open that day. And I'm not saying that it, I mean, the issue of whether it was a good faith challenge or not is beside the point. The issue is what would they have realized had they let
You don't dispute that it was a good faith challenge, do you?
No. But that's beside the point. The issue is what would have happened in a hypothetical Chapter 7 had this played out under Article 4. They did not let this play out under Article 4, but now they want to come back and say, but if we did let it play out, we still would have gotten paid. We submit that the record evidence is more than sufficient to carry our burden on the improvement of position test, and the district court simply didn't analyze.
Well, how can you say that the trier fact here did not perform this hypothetical exercise and determine that it didn't make any difference?
Well, that's essentially what the court said, is in hypothetical, it didn't make any difference because their status would have essentially just ridden through the same either way. And that's where we say the district court got it wrong. And it's really a sort of a mixed question of law and fact. The first question of law is, what is the nature and extent of their security interest? Getting back to the point of their security interest under Article 4 was just to the checks.
Well, we don't have the superior knowledge to say the district court was wrong, though, do we? How can we say that the district court was not wrong if he said, I did a hypothetical analysis and I think it would have come out the same?
Well, again, we would submit that the district court's analysis of that is clearly erroneous based on the law and the record evidence, in that he did not properly apply the improvement of position test on the threshold issue, which is what was their security interest. They would not have had a security interest in the debtor's funds in that account. They did not have that. And the district court didn't recognize that fact, and therefore we submit that the analysis is wrong and should be reversed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.